Are vegans actually unhealthy?
Does cannabis ruin your sleep?
And why are so many men taking testosterone supplements? I'm Mitch.
And I'm Greg.
And we're the creators of the popular YouTube channel ASAP Science.
Every week on our podcast Side Note by ASAP Science, we explain the science behind a controversial subject with recent research, up-to-date studies, and ridiculous stories so you are entertained while, bam, simultaneously learning.
We're here to make science make sense.
Download Side Note by ASAP Science wherever you get your podcasts.
It was a tragedy, the kind that sometimes happen in the North or in other places where people live amongst the kind of wild nature that most of us never experience. Two people died, one of them an infant. A grizzly bear was also killed, and the lone survivor was left traumatized. And then the word got out.
The story of a heartbreaking loss for people who live and work in one of Canada's last wild places. Valérie Théoré
and her 10-month-old daughter were discovered outside of their cabin on Monday.
Théoré's partner, an experienced outdoorsman returning from checking trap lines when
he found bear prints all around the cabin. He became worried for the safety of his spouse and child and began to look for them. That's when the bear attacked him,
shooting and killing the animal in self-defense before discovering the bodies of his partner and infant.
You probably heard this story. You definitely clicked on it if you saw it online. We are drawn to these kind of things, and the media knows that well. So if you ever wondered what kind of story is guaranteed to get international play when it happens in a tiny remote part of the Yukon, this is it. What does that do to the community where the attack occurs? When people who don't live there and don't understand much about a life in the wild read a news report and hit comment, and then share, and then share, and then share. What happens when a fatal grizzly attack goes viral? I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings, and this is The Big Story. Eva Holland is a freelance writer based in the Yukon, and she dug into this piece for Outside Magazine. Hi, Eva.
Hi.
First of all, before we get to everything that happened after the tragedy, can you tell me what occurred on November 28th of last year?
Yeah. So this family, they were on maternity leave from Valerie's job in Whitehorse as a teacher, and they had a cabin a few hours north of Whitehorse outside a community called Mayo, and they had a trap line there, which means a concession where you're permitted to trap small fur-bearing mammals. And Valerie's partner went out for the day on his snowmobile in the morning to check the trap lines. And at some point during that 5-hour window when he was gone, Valerie took her baby Adele and went for a walk on a trail outside the cabin. And she was attacked and killed by a grizzly bear. And when her partner came back, he was attacked, well, charged by the bear as well. And he was able to shoot it and kill it. And then he found his family. Both Valerie and the baby had been killed.
And what did an investigation find happened next or had happened to them?
I think partly because of the fresh snow. I'm not certain, but the investigating parties were able to, which was, I think, the Mounties and conservation officers and Coroner's Service, did a pretty thorough investigation. They were able to retrace some of the bear's activities, and they found that he was an 18-year-old male grizzly. He was starving. He had zero body fat, they said. He shouldn't have been awake, of course, in late November, but he was too skinny to hibernate. He had a previous injury from some time earlier that was mostly healed in his abdomen that my guess is that's what started the starvation process. He would have been hampered maybe during prime foraging season. And he had eaten a porcupine a few days earlier, which would be a really desperate move, and he was full of quills all through his internal organs. And so he had happened along the trail and at some point got wind of Valerie and Adele, and essentially he set up an ambush for them. He hid under some spruce branches just off the trail and waited for them to arrive. From what they were able to determine, she would have had almost no warning whatsoever.
How often did these kind of attacks happen?
They're extremely rare. For how often people here are out and about and encountering bears even, there had been 3 previous grizzly bear-related deaths in the Yukon in the last 20 years or so. So they're quite rare for how many, I mean, there's not that many of us up here, but for how much time we all spend out there and for how often we do encounter bears, fatal attacks are extremely rare.
So tell me, because this is where the story starts to filter down to where the rest of us are. What happened the day after the attack?
Well, the RCMP made their announcement, and then the coroner's service sent out a press release, and then the media coverage began, and it started out locally and then grew really rapidly to national Canadian media, Alaska media, and then to U.S. media, and eventually it went sort of worldwide. The New York Times did a story. The Washington Post did a story. Global sent a reporter up here, which is pretty unusual. We don't get outside TV reporters for much, if anything, up here. And I know that the reporter at the Yukon News, Jackie Hong, who covered the story for the local paper, was getting inquiries from Norwegian outlets. It went viral, essentially.
Why does that happen in situations like this?
I think people are fascinated by the idea that sometimes, you know, humans aren't the most powerful creature in a given scenario still. I think tragedies travel in general. I think tragedies involving a baby specifically tend to travel widely. I do think some people click out of empathy, but not all by any means. And so what happened, of course, is that as it does, the internet filled with judgments from people who know better or think they do. So I think a lot of people pass this story around with a sense of judgment of this family.
Tell me a little bit about what you and the rest of the community up there see when something like this happens from people who are nowhere near the story.
Yeah, we see a real lack of understanding, not just sort of empathy understanding, but even just sort of the mechanics of life up here.
Give me an example or two if you have them.
Sure. You know, a lot of people were suggesting that that anyone who traps animals deserves to die. That would be a bizarre sentiment to anybody who lives up here, where, you know, hunting is normal, fishing is normal, and trapping is normal. And I know a lot of people have emotional reactions to the deaths of animals. But as humans, you know, I think our view up here is that we're all party to the deaths of animals. If we drive a car, if we fly in a plane, if we eat meat, obviously, if we wear leather. And the disconnect between northern or remote communities and southern communities is often around, but it's sort of okay to do that to domestic animals, but wild animals are different. And the view up here is that wild animals are not different. I'm not an expert on this because I'm not a hunter myself, but there's just a real difference of assumptions about what is normal or acceptable behavior and what constitutes cruel and unusual activity.
How familiar is that kind of disconnect to reporters who cover the North? Is it just kind of in that capacity, or does it manifest elsewhere?
I think you get it on hunting stories sometimes. Julia O'Malley, who's a reporter in Alaska, did a really wonderful story for High Country News a couple years ago about a teenage whale hunter in a remote village in Alaska who killed his first whale and was, you know, incredibly proud. He'd participated in this in his culture. He had provided food for his village. And his story went viral, and he got death threats from all over the world. So we are familiar with the phenomenon. It happens on hunting stories. It happens even on, you know, avalanche stories, for instance, would be one that I think reporters in Alberta and BC, too, would be familiar with. Is, you know, somebody gets caught in an avalanche, and here comes the internet to say, oh, had it coming. I don't understand that instinct to say they had it coming. It's a very strange way to react to a tragedy to me.
In the kind of days and weeks after the bear attack, what was it like to cover that story as somebody who lives there for you and the other reporters who are based in that community and are now all of a sudden, I imagine, getting requests from international media? What was that like?
It was tough. I didn't involve myself immediately, but I was talking to my colleagues about it as we went on, and people were inundated with requests, sometimes very inappropriate requests for just, you know, do my work for me and send it over this way and that kind of thing. And there was no sense that we might not want to trust outsiders with contact information, for instance, for people who were grieving. There was a real sense of kind of entitlement from outsiders, I think, to have this story and to have the information that they wanted. It was tough. The public memorial service that was held, they asked that no media attend, which is completely understandable. But for those of us who were both media and part of the community, it meant, you know, I didn't go because I wasn't, you know, I was told not to, but I would have liked to go to not as media, but to support my friends who were grieving. and I didn't feel able to. So that's not that this is by any means about me, but that's an example of the kind of tensions that were in play for people that are both journalists and part of the community. I know that Claudiane Sampson, who I interviewed for the story, was friends with Val. So she did end up going, but she sat right at the back so nobody would think she was there trying to take notes or you know, sort of spy on the proceedings. She was there as a friend, not as a journalist. But it was a tricky spot to be in.
Well, it's tough for us down here when we're setting up to talk to you about this, because I sat down after I read your story and tried to think of how many stories out of the North or remote communities that I've really dug into that haven't been about animal attacks or avalanches or hunting. There are some, but the list is small. And I know that that might be a failing of us down here, but what other stories are up there that just get ignored until something goes horribly wrong?
Yeah, that's a real frustration of reporters up here. We joke about it, but it's hard to get outside media interested in stuff that's not sort of like, yeah, clicky viral animal stories. You know, I think we had one or two outside reporters came up when we had our missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls inquiry hearings here. They were the first ones to be held in the country. And I believe there was three. CBC Indigenous sent someone up, CP sent someone up, and McLean sent someone up. But that was one of the only times since I've been here that we've had outside reporters up here for something that wasn't kind of viral content.
I'm Laura Palmer, host of Island Crime. Season 6, Sweethearts, is the story of three teenage girls who were all murdered in Victoria, Canada, within about 12 months.
So she was scared. Something out there scared her.
You've just created the playground where predators can really thrive.
She was a 16-year-old girl. She was a sweetheart.
Listen to Sweethearts at frequencypodcastnetwork.com or wherever you get podcasts.
Find your frequency.
Well, how do people who live up there, given the way things are covered, feel when all of a sudden there's a new news truck in town or a new reporter? Like it's, I mean, I know it's a city, but it's also kind of a small town, right?
Right. Yeah. We're 25,000 people here. The example I give to Americans is that there's 35,000 people in a territory the size of California instead of 35 million. We're a small community for sure. And depending on the nature of the attention, you know, sometimes small communities like to get some attention from outside, but certainly when it's negative and when it feels like it's intruding on a tragedy, people resent it.
How does the relationship that people in the North have with the wild need to be understood by people like me who don't hear much until these tragedies happen? I mean, you mentioned kind of at the beginning that, you know, people see bears every day and you learn to live with them. And I don't think that's something that we comprehend. And that's why these tragedies maybe to us don't feel as rare as they actually are.
Yeah, that makes sense. You know, my Facebook memory this morning from a couple years ago was me asking if anybody knew if the mother bear and her two cubs was still on the trail behind my house. And I live 3 kilometers from downtown. I don't live out in the sticks, but there are bears in my neighborhood every May and June at a minimum, if not through the whole summer, on the trails that I run and bike on every day. It's completely normal for them to be right in town. Primarily closer to town, it tends to be black bears rather than grizzlies, but black bears are dangerous too. Instead of a water bottle on my mountain bike, I have a can of bear spray. It's just how it is. You expect to encounter bears and you prepare accordingly. And we all know that the majority of the time you encounter them, they walk away, but you have to be prepared for when they don't.
Well, yeah, some of the comments on the social media posts of this story were like, well, why would she take her infant daughter out when there were bears around?
Right. It's like there's bears around houses in Whitehorse. It's not a matter of going deep into the backcountry to be around bears here. If anything, you might see them more frequently around town because there's food for them here. So yeah, that's a good example of the disconnect between our sets of assumptions. Like Claudiane said in my story, you know, bears walk across her driveway and through her yard where her children play. So the idea that Valerie was being irresponsible by bringing her baby into the backcountry is sort of nonsensical to people here. You know, if nobody should ever bring kids where there's bears, then, you know, we're going to need to relocate all the elementary schools in my neighborhood.
Right. Eventually, there was a coroner's report about this attack, right?
Yes.
And what did it say, both about what happened, but also about some of the narratives that had come out in the initial coverage that maybe didn't hold up?
It came out in March, mid late March, I believe. And I think, I hope it brought some comfort to some people here. I know it did, because it was very clear about what happened. They were able to reconstruct a grimly detailed picture of what happened, and they made it clear that it was quick and that it was not preventable, that there's nothing that they could have done differently except simply not be in that place at that moment in time. You know, no amount of weapons would have made a difference, no amount of anything. It was a desperate bear, a predator, and just wrong place, wrong time. And I think that even though that's scary for us to contemplate, that sometimes there's just no solution, it's also, I think, helpful for people who had to deal with all this blame being pointed at their friend to have it stated so clearly that she didn't do anything wrong except having the audacity to be in nature with her child.
How much pickup did the report get in the non-Northern media?
It did get some, not in the States that I noticed the way the initial event did, but it did get some national Canadian media attention, which is nice. Some of the outlets that had covered the initial attack did do follow-ups, but it was primarily a local story at that point.
How's the community doing now?
You know, it's still pretty raw. I was pretty careful about approaching people for this story, but it's still really raw. People are still hurt. They're still very wary to talk to reporters about what happened because of the way everything played out the first time. That's partly why I was so nervous to do this story, is I knew that people would likely agree with what I was saying in the story, but I worried that my community would be upset that I even reopened the wound.
Well, in a place like that, you're going to have to ask the same people questions on the next story you do, and the next one, right? Like, I was a reporter in downtown Toronto and had to also, you know, knock on doors after a shooting or a train fatality or whatever, but the city is 3.5 million people. I was probably not going to run into those folks at the grocery store, and you do.
Absolutely. Yeah, at the grocery store, at the one-room airport, that's a slight exaggeration, but, you know, you never get on a plane here without seeing several people you know. At the emergency room, at Christmas parties, you know, it's the library. You see people you know constantly, and so it's tough to burn bridges.
How does that change the way you approach a story like this?
Well, I'd like to think that I would have tried to be as sensitive as possible, even if I didn't have sort of potential personal social consequences for being insensitive. But it definitely makes you tread with more care. I was very careful about who I approached and how I approached them. I didn't attempt to contact Valerie's partner. He had expressed through the RCMP that he didn't want media reaching out to him, so I respected that. The people that I approached were people that I felt reasonably confident would be at least potentially open to talking, whether that was because of how they had expressed themselves on their own social media or in private conversations with me, that kind of thing. I didn't just contact everyone I knew who knew Val, because I knew that some of them probably didn't want to be bothered. And maybe if I was an outsider, I wouldn't have the same network to, but maybe I would be more aggressive about who I contacted, spread a wider net, that kind of thing.
Well, you know that there's not going to be, at least now, 8 months later, 15 other reporters knocking on the same door.
Yeah, no, it helps to have time. That was one reason too why I asked outside for more time to wait on the story, so that that I wasn't part of kind of a pack.
Well, I hope we can talk to you again when there's a better story.
Yeah, that would be great.
Thanks, Eva.
Thank you.
Eva Holland, freelance journalist, resident Northerner. That was The Big Story. For more from us, head over to thebigstorypodcast.ca. Find us on Twitter at TheBigStoryFPN. And listen to us and subscribe for free absolutely anywhere you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening. I'm Jordan Heath-Rawlings. We'll talk tomorrow.